playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Hello and welcome to the programme. I'm Fiona Kelly and I'm standing in for Marion Richardson for this, your first playback of 2019. Being the week that was in it, there was lots of looking back at the year just gone and looking forward to the year ahead on the airwaves. But first up this morning, the story that captured everyone's imagination towards the end of the week was Armagh couple Frances and Patrick Connolly's win of just under €130 million in the EuroMillions jackpot on New Year's Day. On yesterday's News at One, Tommy Gorman spoke to the lucky couple.
We're just ordinary down-to-earth people. We live the same lives as everybody else. We pay the bills at the end of the month, try to squeeze a few luxuries out of the wages, drag things out, have a bit of fun. We're just loving people.
Yeah, no, look, we've got a lovely family, lovely group of friends. We like going out for a nice meal and calling around to people's houses and having people around to our house. And love seeing the family and the grandkids. Oh. So just normal everyday people.
Yeah, we lived in Hartlepool for 25 years and the door never was locked. People come in when they wanted to and loved coming to our house, and that made us happy.
So you have three daughters, three girls. Yes. Are they now going to be millionaires as a result
100%.
Of this?
Yep. Oh, many times over. It'll be getting shared.
And were ye lucky people before, or is this something completely new for you?
Not a chance. We've done the lotto from day one. And we do it by direct debit and never look. And I don't think we won three tenors the whole time we've been doing it. Not a thing. Not a bit of luck at all. In fact, we used to always joke in our family, my brother's very lucky. And the first thing he said to me was, supposed to be me that won that. He's out in Australia. I got him out of his bed at 5:30 in the morning yesterday.
Yeah, no, we don't win things, you know. It was a surprise, totally out of the blue. Yeah, it is one of those ones that you pick a lucky dip and suddenly you win. You know, it just doesn't happen. It doesn't happen to people like us, but it does.
And my final question for you, you have all this money now. Is it going to change, or what are you going to do with it?
Well, it's not going to change us, because we're too old and too set in our ways to be bothered changing. We are who we are, and people don't know me very long before they know what you see is what you get. But it's a lot of money. It's not going to not change our lives. It'd be a waste of money just leaving it sitting in the bank, wouldn't it? So yeah, we'll get round to doing the house thing and the car thing and the holiday thing and probably clothes and jewellery and what. I'm not a shopper, but I'm sure I'll get used to it.
And Michael, the luckiest man in the world, who did it online when you hadn't bought the ticket while out shopping?
No, we just ordered a lucky dip online. Francis reminded me, we forgot to get a ticket. Can you go online and do it? Never usually check, just waiting an email coming through. Just that one night I thought, I'll check before I go to bed. And all the boxes were ticked. And even at that stage, we just didn't dream of the scale of it. You know, it's the Euro Millions. It can be 20 people, 30 people, 100 people maybe win it. You know, just to see one winner and all that money for one person just seemed unreal, and it still seems
we
unreal.
We genuinely are living proof that it can happen to anybody, because we are anybody.
EuroMillions winners Frances and Patrick Connolly talking to Tommy Gorman on Friday's News at One. On Tuesday, we heard about the death from cervical cancer in the Netherlands this week of 58-year-old Limerick woman Adrienne Cullen, who was married to former RTÉ correspondent Peter Klusky. Adrienne's case was similar to that of the women at the centre of our own cervical check controversy, who are taking legal action on foot of their misdiagnosis since she successfully sued a Dutch hospital for medical negligence. On Tuesday's News at One, Claire Byrne spoke to Professor John O'Higgins, Professor in Obstetrics and Gynaecology at University College Cork, about Adrienne's recent visit to the college just 3 weeks ago.
She came to Cork. She was receiving an honorary degree from UCC, and she came to us the afternoon before that here in Cork University Maternity Hospital. Now, we were a little, we didn't know her. We were a little bit cautious about how the engagement would go. But everyone who met her was touched by her courage. She was an inspirational lady, and what we did was we essentially got her to meet a wide group of staff, medical, midwifery staff, administration staff, the full range of people who work here, and she told us her story. And what she told us was, she was very frank, very honest. She said, look, I'm terminally ill. And she explained some of the errors and some of the mistakes that had been made in her care and what she was doing and what she was campaigning at that stage to do in Holland to change the way they dealt with issues around open disclosure. One of the things that was very striking for us was that she travelled from the Netherlands with her husband, Peter, and also with the head of the obstetrics and gynaecology service in that hospital. And in essence, the clinicians who probably felt they had made the mistake became allies with her as she tackled the bigger system in terms of insisting on frank and open disclosure. And it was the human aspect to her story, the sheer courage she had, which certainly impacted on all the staff. And I know that everybody here and everyone in UCC would pass on our deep condolences to her husband, Peter, and her wider family. But anyone who was there on that Monday afternoon and heard her and saw her speak, and she spoke to us. It was a conversation. We didn't have a lecture. We had a sort of circle of staff, and she sat in the middle and spoke to us. Anyone who's there will remember that, I think, forever. Certainly she impacted in a way that I can't remember an engagement in recent times impacting on us. That's why we were so sad to hear today that she had passed away yesterday.
Professor John O'Higgins of UCC paying tribute to the late Adrian Cullen. A key element of Adrian's case in its latter stages was her battle against the hospital's attempt to prevent her from speaking publicly about her experience. In an excerpt from a speech which she recorded last October, which we heard on Wednesday's Morning Ireland, Adrian detailed that particular aspect of her ordeal.
I think it was the 5th of November on 2015 we received the first gagging clause. It was in Dutch and our lawyer translated it for us. And we said no. We said absolutely not. And then there was silence from UMC Utrecht. And then eventually they came back to us. And there was a different form of wording. But it didn't really substantially change the issue that we weren't allowed to speak about what had happened. So again, we said absolutely not. Now, it sounds very easy in retrospect that you say, absolutely not, never. But believe me, it wasn't easy. And there were times when I said, let's just sign the darn thing. I don't care. I just want you to be okay. But we couldn't do it. It's wrong. It is absolutely wrong ever to sign that. And the responsibility should never be on the patient to decide whether to sign it or not. The responsibility is on the hospital and on the hospital lawyers to never present such a clause to a patient. It was very important in our case to go public with what had happened, because when you have the strength of public opinion behind you, the only thing that hospital leaderships seem to respond to is being shamed in public. If they feel that their hospital's reputation is being damaged, it concentrates their mind and they will respond differently. It's not possible for every patient to do that because sometimes you're just too sick to.
The late Adrian Cullen as heard on Wednesday's Morning Ireland. Vicky Phelan is one of the Irish women at the centre of the controversy in this country about the misdiagnosis of cervical cancer. Vicky was a guest on an all-female panel on Sunday with Miriam in the company of feminist Alva Smith, writers Emer McLysett and Sarah Breen, and domestic abuse campaigner Jessica Bowes. At this point in the programme, Vicky Phelan recalls a woman she encountered recently at a meeting.
And this lady came up to me, one of the women affected in the group, because when we had our first day of our launch, I spoke first and I said, right, I said to Stephen Slarius, I said, right, I'm going to go all at this Full Metal Jacket now, talk about sex. And he went, oh, Jesus, she's off again, you know. But, you know, he understood, you know, because he thought, well, it's going to look better, you know, and they'll appreciate it coming from you. And
this girl, is that Stephen Teep?
Yeah. And we had this discussion and he said he himself and Irene would have had the same problems when she was going through her treatment and she was only 35 when she died. So you can imagine, you know, I mean, having no sex life in your 30s, I mean, you know, Jesus. But this girl came up to me afterwards. She was only 32. And when she was diagnosed with cervical cancer, she didn't have a boyfriend or a partner. So she gets this diagnosis, goes off and has all her treatment. And the treatment is horrendous. You know, in some cases, some women can have a sex life again. In most cases, they can't. This girl can't have sex again because they did surgery that shortened her vagina, narrowed her vagina. vagina, and like she's out now trying to meet somebody, and like she just broke down. I got so upset because I thought, here she is, beautiful 32-year-old girl, hasn't got a boyfriend, and she says to me, Vicky, how am I going to go and meet somebody? How do you have that conversation with the man when sex is off the table? Do you, you know, that's I just terrible, don't think people realise the extent of the damage that this cancer has on your body, on your sense of being a woman even, you know, because that's taken away from you, and you're hitting early menopause at 30 or 40. Or, do you know, it's horrendous, horrendous. So I just felt I needed to come out and talk about it because then it might help other people, and that's kind of what's happened.
But your honesty helped, in other words, that 32-year-old woman, because probably no one else would bring it up with her.
No, she never spoke about it to anybody except for her doctor.
Certainly a year in which actually the men of Ireland have also had to take cognizance of and be aware of women's sexuality and sex lives. And I think that that's also an incredibly good thing, because I mean, who ever talked very openly about sex in this
Nobody.
Country? Completely prohibited. And I just think that's so important. I mean, certainly during the repeal campaign, there were many times when you'd be trying to work out the date from when do you start the 12-week period. This was a great discussion we had. I won't name any names, but there was a bunch of men around a table and they were having to talk about periods and menstruation. Their faces were scarlet. Their faces were scarlet. The women were sitting back thinking, that's very good, but they have to do this now.
Yeah.
But it's so ridiculous to have a world in which people won't talk about
bodily
sex.
Functions,
bodily and vaginas on the radio, for example.
And on that note,
from last week's Sunday with Miriam, another woman heard on air this week was Beth Wallace, who featured in a report by Brian O'Connell on the Today Show on Wednesday. Beth herself was adopted, and following a meeting with a social worker in 2005, she discovered that she also had a brother called Stephen, who was born in a mother and baby home and who died in infancy in 1972, having established that Stephen is buried in an unmarked grave in Dean's Grange Cemetery in Dublin. Beth is now determined to erect a gravestone in his memory. Brian joined Beth as they located Stephen's burial place.
We're basically in the undergrowth of what looks like the oldest part of the cemetery, surrounded by gravestones that are both completely covered in ivy and more or less partially covered with ivy. And it is very dishevelled, it is very untidy looking. There are lots of branches lying around. The only assumption I can make is that somewhere within this area of maybe, I don't know, 40 feet or so, that the grave must be. And I can see, like, there's a line here that looks like sort of the ground has been disturbed, and there's another sort of mound here.
So there's no markings anywhere?
There's no markings. I mean, you would think this was woodland.
You know your brother is here?
Yes, 100%. 56A1 South Section, Dean's Grange.
How does it make you feel standing here on what is quite an anonymous little patch of ground?
Oh, I'm struggling to find words, actually. I don't think that any child should be buried in anonymity. I don't think the grave of any child should be invisible. But I think especially the children born in mother and baby homes. And that's the reason why I wanted to do this, was so that his, you know, very short life, you know, and the records conflict. One, the adoption agency said he was a few months old when he died. The cemetery records say he was 3 weeks old when he died. His death certificate and birth certificate, when I compare them, say that he was 5 weeks old. So the information really conflicts. But someone so small, you know, such a small life. And I know that only three people went to his funeral because he was born in silence, secrecy and shame. You know, nobody knew of his birth.
Do you know anything about that day when he was buried here?
No. I know that the social worker from the adoption agency attended the funeral with my birth mother and the priest. And that's it. And that's all I know.
Three of them here in this pretty lonely, out-of-the-way part of the cemetery.
In February. So it was cold, no leaves on the trees. I imagine it to have been a very lonely experience for her.
Beth Wallace talking to Brian O'Connell on the Today Show on Wednesday. There was a lot of excitement this week about space exploration, with NASA sending back pictures from the most distant point ever explored by humankind, followed by the Chinese landing of a robotic craft on the far side of the moon. You might have heard mention of Ultima Thule in relation to the NASA expedition. So what exactly is Ultima Thule? Who better to tell us than space expert extraordinaire Leo Enright? He spoke to Audrey Carville on Wednesday's Morning Ireland.
It's a very, very small and very, very cold object, a very, very long way away, as you said. It's actually, to try and get our head around what we're talking about here, it's about the size of the Isle of Man. We saw our first fuzzy picture of it yesterday afternoon, and this really is exploration at its finest. But in this case, I think what's really exciting is the shape is intriguing. There are hints that there's something odd about this object. And if this is two smaller objects, between them just 30 kilometers across, orbiting around each other out there in the darkness, the pictures will really be jaw-dropping.
It's absolutely extraordinary, because when the probe New Horizons was launched, left Earth 10 years ago, this whole zone where it has been taking these images wasn't even discovered.
Yes, absolutely right. And I think this is one of the most exciting things from an Irish perspective, is that we've begun to realise just in the past decade the existence of this outer zone of the solar system, which had only ever before been suggested, it had been postulated by an Irish astronomer, Kenneth Edgeworth, back in the 1940s. Edgeworth said, after all the planets had formed, there must have been, he said, left over out there, far out, way out on the edges of the solar system, these smaller objects, and he said there could be thousands of them. We now know that Edgeworth was right, but now only now have the telescopes that can see these things, and the spacecraft, most excitingly, that can actually go out and today, for the first time, explore.
And Leo, we have discussed this before about all of this exploration that's going on, how critically important it is, but also the big ethical questions that are faced about what to do about what is out there, if anything.
Yes, I mean, we're really in a new era of exploration. I mean, this really does compare to the great era of European exploration, or the Chinese era of exploration, or even, dare I say it, the Irish explorations of the 500, 600 BC, or AD rather. We are learning about new worlds. And even, I have to admit, I've been up all night because we're just on the cusp of another exploration. The Chinese are preparing, probably in the next 12 hours, to land a robot explorer on the far side of the moon. So one of my colleagues tweeted plaintively during the week. He said, please, please stop doing stuff. I'm exhausted.
Leo Enright, as heard, talking to Audrey Carville on Wednesday's Morning Ireland. And speaking of space travel, Tuesday's Colm O'Regan Wants a Word focused on our national obsession with the weather, and in this sketch, how the soundtrack of a rather famous space mission might have sounded if there had been an Irishman at the mic.
One thing about the weather here in Ireland is we love it as a subject of small talk. We talk about it in the strangest of places. I imagine even at the moon landing, for example.
Okay, we see you, Neil, coming down the stairs.
This is one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind.
Okay, Buzz, you can go.
Oh, really? Like, I'm second? Yeah, hey, listen, it's fine. I'm actually 8 months older than Neil, but look, it's fine. Don't worry about it.
But there was a third person up there in that module, Irish-American Michael Collins.
Okay, Michael, you can go down.
Oh, grand, yeah. What's the weather like back home? Is it warm? It's freezing here. No atmosphere either. Ha! Dead! Ha!
Paul Tyleck and Tara Flynn, as heard on Colm O'Regan Wants a Word on Tuesday. Welcome back to the first playback of 2019. I'm Fiona Kelly and I'm standing in this morning for Marion Richardson. On last week's Saturday with Cormac O'Hara, we heard from three people, Joanna Dukipati from Mumbai in India, Laura Babil from Mauritius and Mick O'Gorman from Britain, who all became Irish citizens during 2018. At this point in the conversation, Mick recalls the day he received his citizenship.
When I went to Killarney, we were looked after really nicely and we sat down, we were entertained by the army band. And then they said, will you stand whilst we present the colour? And three soldiers walked across the stage with a tricolour. And I found that quite emotional. Mm-hmm. And after that, there was a minister, Minister Staunton, and Judge...
Brian McMahon, was it?
Brian McMahon, indeed. And I've never really had a country defined before. I mean, I just grew up in my own, you know, mm-hmm. and... It was extraordinary because the speech contained elements of, you know, you're all very welcome, you're all citizens, you're from 120 different countries. Whatever you do, don't leave your customs behind, bring your music, bring your cooking. And then Brian McMahon said, my family's been here 600 years, but as of this moment, you're the same as me. And I thought that was very special.
Straight away equality, and that's
yeah, he just regard. Yeah, no, it was beautifully defined. Mm. Well, it was softly defined, but it was very embracing, and very unusual because we live in a world of xenophobia, and this was completely the opposite.
Embracing and disarming, isn't that right? How you describe it, Mick? Anyway, how did you find the ceremony, Joanna?
I was sitting right on the front row. I'm just that kind of a person. I'm really short and I need the best view in the house.
So you put yourself in the front row?
Yeah, I did. Because you could sit wherever you wanted. And I could see, you know, I think the structure of the ceremony is pretty similar to every ceremony. So we also had the army, but this was in Dublin and it was really special that morning. You know, I was very fidgety. Because I wore a lovely sari, which had colours very similar to the Irish, you know, colours. And I was very fidgety with my sari. I was like, it's not going. I think I was just very nervous. Mm-hmm. And my son was there. John was there as well. So the three of us were there, the main reason why I became Irish. And there was a thing in the speech where, of course, about inclusion, integration and respect and our own cultures, you know, all the basic amazing points were covered. But it was the same week when I was launching my a magazine here in Cork. And he said something about wishing us the very best in all our endeavours and to just remember from where we've come from and to bring that wherever we go as well. And I thought as if he had written that speech especially for me, as if to mm-hmm. say, good luck in your new thing that you're starting in Cork. Everybody else was zoned out as far as I was concerned. And it was just me and the minister. And it was like this one-on-one feeling. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I was sitting next to a lady from Syria, and on the other side, I think, if I remember, was a lady from a different part of Asia. And we were all just really taken by the warmth of the day.
Joanna Dookie Patty there, as heard on last week's Saturday with Cormac O'Hara. Limerick's win in the All-Ireland hurling final was undoubtedly one of the great sporting events of 2018. Limerick woman Petula Martin made a wonderful documentary that captured all the excitement of that win, which was aired last Sunday. In this excerpt, first up, you'll hear Keane Lynch's mum, Valerie, recalling how, with a little help from some other Limerick supporters, she managed to make it onto the pitch moments after the final whistle blew.
The whistle has gone. And the next minute, I'm up in the air because I had heard Ballybrown supporters, and they know who they are. They said, there's Keane Lynch's mother, let's get her in. And I was up and over before I realised it. So I'm in stage one and I nearly died because I didn't really think. And I said, God. So now there was these beautiful suited men. One of them came towards me and I beckoned him with my finger and I just went into his ear quite charmingly. And I think I picked the right one because, you know, by the look, you know the way the women can tell, I choose the right guy. I said, one moment, one hug, and I'll come back. Your tiny love, go on. And I didn't have far to go because Keane was still standing at the spot where the match was over. Keane hadn't moved a centimetre. And then when I got there, I realised he wasn't moving or reacting. He was shocked. So I did give him a slap on the back. And he went, oh, ma'am. And he just kind of had a moment on my shoulder. I rubbed him up and down. And I told him, so proud of you. Go away and enjoy it. And I pushed him on.
Tom Condon is our local man. And I mean, Tom has given his life to hurling. We played together. Do you know, when he was 17, we won a county. So he's given his life to it. So there's very little out of hurling if you win. Unless you win. Do you know, no one remembers the team of the 80s and the 81s and 82s. But my kids will remember Tom Condon for catching the last ball for the next 40 years. We all will.
At the final whistle, a picture of Dara hugging his sons was captured by a Galway supporter.
The girl that took the photograph was Sean Bombernick's daughter. I didn't actually realise that she had taken it. I had told him the score. I was hugging a guy that was beside me from Galway, and he said, "I wish you the best of luck, you deserved every bit of it." After the whole match was over, she said, "Do you mind me getting your number off you? I have a few lovely pictures of your family." And I said, "No problem at all." So she sent it on to me. It was unreal. When I showed it to Michelle, it was special because she didn't see what, as a family, we had happened, what we had done, that I hugged my two kids. And it made it all more special that I just wanted the two lads there to kind of replicate what my dad did for me. It was an incredible thing for a Galway supporter to do. I mean, it's up on the wall here at home. My kids will have it till the day they die. When I implant it, they'll be able to hopefully take their kids.
Declan Hannan lifted the cup, and I remember the yellow confetti flying into the air and Dolores O'Riordan and the Cranberries song starting. And the tears just welled up and they flowed and flowed and flowed. We'd lost Dolores, obviously, in January. Her songs had been played at other games, were played at the Cork game, Linger was played over the speakers. She was almost like a 16th man, I think, on the day for a lot of people, and she would have been in a lot of people's thoughts. And then when her song started, and it's such a kind of an anthem as well, Dreams, and it was just the perfect song for the perfect moment.
Áine Fitzgerald, Dara Maloney and Valerie Lynch, as heard on Petula Martin's documentary Limerick, Pure Proud, last Sunday. Now, you'll have heard reference to the death of Dolores O'Riordan in Petula's documentary there. Well, the untimely death of the Cranberries lead singer was also discussed in Jim Lockhart's final partings programme, which paid tribute to some of the musicians who died in 2018. One of those who Jim and his panel remembered was our own RTE colleague, Sandy Harsh.
Only a few weeks ago, we lost a colleague and a very dear friend, Sandy Harsh. Her sudden death came as a great shock to all of us. And she was bubbly and cheerful and mischievous to the end. She actually said to me, "I don't mind not being on the programme. I don't want to be in it." So, Carl, you knew Sandy in her early days in Dublin.
She was one of the first people I met when she was a writer and photographer with Hot Press magazine. We're talking about the late 1970s. And Sandy was so good to me across the years and was a great friend. But she was so generous. I think that's the thing about it, that you know, she was generous with her music knowledge. She loved talking about music and swapping stories and learning about new music if it was something new to her. But her knowledge was vast. And I always loved listening to her country music programs. And country music wouldn't be one of my fortes, but Sandy made it special because of her enthusiasm and her knowledge. And she drew you in. And I think that's, you know, and she wasn't a traditional disc jockey by any means. She was much more like a person, that for me, the ideal, which is somebody who's in their sitting room saying, "You got to hear this. And if you love this, you're going to love that."
She had a great radio voice.
Yeah, she did. And it was quite unique. And anytime if I stumbled on her show, I never left it, you know, like and other times you'd have to search it out.
I was listening to her one time in the car and she was doing... She had, I think, two or three programs of banjo music, brilliant country banjo. And I ran into her in the corridor and said, "I loved your banjo program." And she looked at me and said, "I got two sacks of hate mail."
I probably wrote one of those.
But it was her generosity of spirit. Yeah. It was that great, she had a great spirit about everything, about life in general.
Yeah, and there's just a wonderful human being, you know, Sandy was. And I'm still in shock at her death. I really am.
Carl Sigdinis there remembering Sandy Harsh in the company of Jim Lockhart and guests on Final Partings on Monday. Another late great figure from the Irish music industry who was remembered on this week's Ray D'Arcy show, presented by Brenda Donoghue, was Phil Lynott. Television director Brian Redden has made a documentary about the making of the video for the song Old Town. And on Wednesday, he came in to tell Brenda, in the company of Angus McAnally, all about it.
It came at an important point in his life because the song came in 1982. So what had happened was, at that point, Thin Lizzy were more or less falling apart. They broke up in 83. So 1 year later, there was no more Lizzy. They were gone. So It was the second solo album. His first solo album hadn't done terribly well, and it was important for him to develop as a solo artist. So this is from his second album. His first album was called Solo in Soho, wasn't it? And the second one is called the Philip Lynott album. And this was one of the tracks from it. So it was important for him that this be a hit, because he needed to really help, you know, launch his solo career. He'd already seen the writing on the wall as far as Lizzie were concerned. There'd been lots of problems in the band, lots of changes of personnel. He had moved back to Ireland at this point, so he had actually come home. And it was very important for him that this be a hit. And it wasn't a hit for him. So what happened was the record company had lost faith in him. His first album, solo album, hadn't done well. The second solo album wasn't doing great. And he said, I need to get a video for this. You know, like, no one's going to see this thing unless you get a video. And they wouldn't give him, they wouldn't do it. They wouldn't support him. They said no. So he was sitting there going, what am I going to do? I have this single. I'm very, you know, I think it's a great single. I need a video. I need to get it out there. So he rang his friend, Dave Heffernan, who was the co-presenter of Enton Goes Along with Angus here. And he said, look, would any chance you'd make a video for me? He says, absolutely. Phil Lynott wants to make a video.
Of course
we will. They win. So I mean, 2 days, they had a crew. Ken Murphy was the cameraman, and Ken is a great RT cameraman who had shot Strumpet City, among many other things, you know, a brilliant, brilliant cameraman. And for Ken, Ken thought this was a real come down for him, because Jerry Gregg, who directed the promo video, said to me that when they went out to shoot it, Ken was thinking, who is this singer ruining my shots?
Do you not realise who, you know, I've worked
I'm getting
with?
Beautiful shots of the Haven Vision. This guy's got to walk through it and ruin it. So it was very important for him that, but this thing was a hit, but it wasn't. So he goes and makes the video, and Jerry sits down, Jerry Gregg, the director, and he gets all these iconic locations, the Halfpenny Bridge, the Long Hall. They go to Grafton Street, and he says, you know what, you couldn't do it today, but he says, we're going to wing it, right? Just walk up Grafton Street, he says to Phil. You know, and we'll just capture people as they come along. And funny enough, actually, I got a couple of tweets after the documentary went out from a girl from Loretto College in Wexford, for Gorey, actually, who were on a day out on an art trip. Their art teacher had brought them up to Dublin to bring them to see some museum. And as they walked down Grafton Street, they were filmed behind Phil Lynott. And she sent me a message to say, that's me in my school uniform and a gabardine behind Phil Lynott.
If you were doing that now, everyone would have to sign some
release form. You have to have
posters up everywhere saying you're filming. You hit the nail on the head there. When those people are looking at him, that's for real. They're going, my God, look at this guy. They weren't expecting him to be there.
Yeah.
And he walks by like an Adonis, like a god. Now, bearing in mind, the man was very tall. He was about 6'4", 6'5", was he? He was only 32 years of age. The prime of his life when he recorded All Town. But he'd already been gripped by drug addiction, and alcohol had played its part as well, which, you know, had a lot to do with the breakup of Lizzie, because he'd become quite unreliable and you couldn't really depend on him. And as Jerry said, he had a bottle in his pocket, a negative, I don't know whether it was vodka or whiskey or whatever, but he was nipping from that all the way throughout the shoot. He became and was always so synonymous with Dublin. You can't separate Dublin and Philly.
I've been spending my money in the old town. It's not the same, honey, when you're not around. I've been spending my time in the old town. I sure miss you, honey, now you're not around. Now you're not around this old town.
Welcome back to the programme. Fiona Kelly here, standing in for Marion Richardson. On Sunday, This Week played an excerpt from their 50th anniversary programme, which was recorded recently in front of a live audience. First up is a memorable interview which Gerald Barry did with the then Taoiseach Charles Haughey in 1982 during a heave against his party leadership, followed by Sean O'Rourke's memories of interviewing Mr. Haughey.
And I'm going to argue very strongly and insist, possibly insist, on an open roll call vote, so that everybody will have to stand up and be counted. And if they're a Fianna Fáil deputy, they're going to be asked to stand by the pledge on which they were elected and support their government and support their party and cut out this business of Taighagaw Have ambivalence, being, as I said, in the party but not for the party.
A journalistic admirer of yours wrote recently, and in the past tense too,
I'm glad to know that I have such a thing.
He could have been a very good Taoiseach, and I'm referring to John Healy. He could have been a very good Taoiseach, but he was as cursed in his friends as he was blessed in his enemies. He paid the price.
Well, I have paid no price yet, and I can tell you this much, that we are going to have this decision next Wednesday. I'm absolutely confident about the outcome, and as Sean McEntee said on another occasion to some other journalist, go dance on somebody else's grave.
Sean O'Rourke, you remember him as a very challenging interview too.
I do, and listening to that, it puts goose pimples on the back. The hairs are rising on the back of my head as I'm listening to it. Yes, Charles Haughey was a very formidable interviewee. I mean, Garrett was formidable in a different way, but I think it's true to say that Charlie set out to strike terror into the heart of not just the interviewer, but also the bosses. I mean, a classic thing he would do, and Michael Good, who is a wonderful supporter of the programme, both as a staffer and also as head of Radio News, will recall. I mean, Charlie's big trick was he'd arrive early. He'd be due at 10:30 to record the interview, and he'd arrive at 20 past, and he would sort of catch the DG maybe sort of still getting out of his car, and the lads would have to rush over and sort of to greet him. I remember an occasion he walked in and there were two Vincents to greet him. One was Vincent Scally, who looked after hospitality, and the other was Vincent Finn, the director general. And he made a beeline for Vincent Scally, and he was all over him, saying, "Vincent, how are you? And how's your sister? And how's everybody keeping?" And then he kind of turned derisively to the DG and said, "Jesus, Finn, are you here still? I thought you were dead." and then we proceeded up the stairs. There was another occasion I decided, you know, I think this, it could be my turn today. And anyway, he comes through the studio, or comes through the door of RT, and he says, "O'Rourke," he says, "I'm going to stick it into you today." And this was like for openers. And somehow I was ready for him. And I said, "Geez, you know," I said, "Taoiseach, that's very interesting." I said, "You're giving me the McLyons treatment." And he kind of looked at me and says, "What do you mean, McLyons?" McLyons was a famous, hard-hitting full-back on the Meath football team when Meath had a decent football team. And he says, "Mick Lyons, what?" I says, "You heard what he said to the Wicklow full forward last week?" "Well, no, what?" He says, "Who's your next of kin?" And we kind of, I think that was the moment I stopped being afraid of Charles Haughey.
Sean O'Rourke there talking to Carol Coleman at the anniversary programme to mark this week's 50th year on air. And if you want to hear more from that recording, you can find it in full on the programme's website. Callan's Kicks finished the year with a programme that took a look back at 2018, a year in which, of course, Michael D. Higgins was re-elected as president.
Yes! Don't open all the champagne, my little manny.
What?
The New Year's Eve party doesn't begin for hours.
It's New Year's Eve?
Why else would we have champagne?
Because it's Monday and I'm the president. # unvouched expenses.
You might actually have to account for them properly, you know.
Ugh.
And not just slip them under a Brexit news avalanche like you did a few weeks ago.
Nonsense. Besides, I don't even drink champagne. I just bathe in it.
It's been such a wonderful year, though, Michael D.
You'll address me as President Sabina. You are also one of my subjects. And yes, I was elected in a landslide for another 7 years.
Years?
That's what I said. Years.
Who would have thought, with everything going on, that Ireland would elect as president...
Thank you.
...a multi-millionaire landlord?
What? You mean poet president?
Millionaire poet?
Yeah, but I'm not some vulgar capitalist like a dragon. I made my millions from taxpayers, just how Fidel would have wanted.
Then let's not forget the election itself.
Ugh.
Or do you even remember?
Well,
since you didn't show up for most of it.
I was washing my hair in champagne.
Oh, my little Manny. That October was an experience no one will ever forget.
Oh, it was all so frightfully beneath me.
Peter Casey, why do you think you've done well in this campaign?
I'm a walking, talking internet comment section. You know, people really connect with me because, what do you call it? I have a face that represents all the horrible things they think, but don't say because they've done no research.
Leonie Rita, are you embarrassed to be here?
I'm proud to be the candidate for Sinn Féin.
Sorry, why are you whispering that?
Because the name of the party is in small print, but I'm really proud of Sinn Féin.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Aye, Lord Lieutenant. And Gavin Duffy, just want to say I don't have any skeletons in the closet because I pulled them out and ran them over in my Porsche. Ran them over good.
Dear.
Vulgar, vulgar, vulgar.
Joan Freeman, have you any policy for this election?
Darkness into light.
Anything else?
Darkness into...
Forget it.
Paz, if I can come in here, I am the human embodiment of 7 years of bitterness and begrudgery. but I'm balanced.
Because, Sean, you've a chip on both shoulders, yeah.
I'm an entrepreneur and a never-ending episode of Reeling in the Years 2011 with fewer envelopes.
Michael D., your expenses raise a lot of questions.
One is above such impertinent questions. One is 10,000 feet above such questions. In my Learjet, with my feet up, wearing Seamus Heaney pyjamas and grooming the dogs with taxpayers' 50 euro notes. So shut the f*** up.
Peter Casey, the future for you?
I will be a voice for Donegal and run in the next general election to take my seat in, Westminster?
Gavin Duffy, you got 2%, the worst ever result in the worst ever president election.
Yeah.
Ipso facto, you're about as popular as hailstones at a wedding.
Hashtag me too.
It is an honour to sign the bill repealing the 8th. Next, we have to repeal the 12th, the article of the Constitution that restricts my bodily autonomy, as it only allows me serve 2 terms.
From Callan's Kicks, Claudia Boyle was one of Miriam O'Callaghan's guests on the Today Show on Friday when she told Miriam about some of the operatic projects she has in the pipeline for 2019.
I've got a lot coming up. I have a one-woman opera with Irish National Opera, and that's going to be about Rosemary Kennedy. Very, very interesting story, and so relative today with the whole Me Too movement and the patriarchy and how she was treated. So that's going to be a very kind of intense, heavy opera, but I think it's going to be really great. Brand new opera by Brian Irvine, and then I'll make my debut with Covent Garden at the end of the year. So,
now that's exciting.
It is very exciting, yeah, for any opera singer, that's where you want to be. Yeah.
And is that something you used to dream about as a young girl when you were singing that you would one day get to Covent Garden?
Yeah, like I was that young child with the hairbrush singing into the mirror and then, you know, pretending I had an Oscar. So, yeah, no, it's a dream come true.
And I know you also performed the G20 summit last year, but I love the fact your lucky charm is a miraculous medal. Once owned by Maria Callas.
Yeah. Oh, that was, I mean, that's one of the most special things I have to say. Mm. I won the Maria Callas competition, I think, 4 years ago, maybe now, in Verona. And her family were there at the time. And that night, they decided they just wanted to present me with her miraculous medal that she owned and wore. So I bring it to every concert with me now. It's a really good luck charm and it's something I value so much.
Such, so beautiful to have got that.
Oh, it's amazing. And she was very religious as well. And I'm just such a huge fan. I know all of her recordings. So for any young opera singer, and especially to have that, it's so special.
That's about my lot for this week. Marion's back in this chair next Saturday. To play us out, here's Claudia Boyle singing Gilbert and Sullivan's Poor Wandering One, as heard on yesterday's Today Show. I hope you've enjoyed my selection and playback this morning. So until the next time, goodbye.
Poor wandering one, though thou hast trolley strings,